This is Joy Fisher, and this is tape 2 in the interview with Debbie Yaffe. And I'm taping this on February 17th, 2009, in Debbie's home in Victoria. Okay, Debbie, thanks again for agreeing to these interviews. I wanted to ask you some follow-up questions based on the responses that you gave during our first interview on February 2nd. But before I get into those, I'd like to ask you some questions that were specifically framed by the teacher who thought that I might not be covering a particular part of the topic as well as she would like. So here's the first question. What was your ideology and what was the basis of it?
Oh, something simple to start with.
I know.
Oh, okay. You mean in the women's movement?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, it changed a lot. It changed a lot with over the years with who I met and my experience and blah, blah, blah. But let me think. I came into it with no particularly feminist ideology at all. My background was more left politics. Mm-hmm. Socialist politics and the 60s, you know, free speech movement at UCLA and the civil rights movement, anti-war movement, but nothing specific to women. And when I first got involved in the women's movement in London, in I think it was 1970, again, I had no preconceived ideas. I just really wanted to meet women. I kind of drifted around more between radical feminism and socialist feminism. Socialist feminism being represented at that time by a variety of, Communist Party groups, Maoist groups, Trotskyist groups. The socialists as such didn't figure. It was more communists and left to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to lots of different meetings to try and figure out how I felt and where I stood about all this stuff. The Communist Party line on women, it was more of just a strict class line. And it wasn't that interesting to me, I guess. The Maoists very quickly were perceived as the women were like fronts for the men in those groups. And they were very quickly perceived as not really very feminist. They were just like trying to recruit for the, mm-hmm. the Maoist groups. Some of the Trot groups, I mean, this is, you know, London in the 70s, every group had gradations.
Right.
There were two Trot groups. again, they were the more interesting to me, but they didn't... The socialist groups in general had a very good take on working class women, but I wasn't a working class woman, certainly at that time. I was living a pretty comfortable middle-class life. So in a way, what it would have required of me would have been to be a feminist for other women. And increasingly, my take on feminism was that every woman got to make the movement that was about her and her stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to be the center of my own movement, and you got to be the center of your own movement. And the idea was if we all worked on our own issues with other women who shared those issues, from our own standpoints, between us as women, we would cover all the issues, mm-hmm. and we would essentially be working together, even when we weren't necessarily. Mm-hmm. Which, as you can see, then that was converging more on a radical feminist line of all women are oppressed by the class of men. I mean, when I was teaching the history of the women's movement, I sort of put it very simplistically, but it kind of worked, that what we were doing was asking questions, what's the matter? Why is it that we're oppressed? And socialism basically came up with the answer, we're oppressed because of the fallout from capitalism. The problem is capitalism, and the solution is communist revolution. And radical feminists said we're oppressed because of male power. The problem is men. The solution is women. And I guess more and more I did come to see it that way. I would go to radical feminist meetings and conferences and be really taken up and engaged by all the personal stuff. My heart was in it. Part of me was also saying, but wait a minute, what about class? What about money? Mm-hmm. What about work? And I never thought they had a good enough line on really class and work and money and the fact that women are in such different material circumstances. Mm-hmm. But then I would go to the socialist meetings and the socialist feminist conferences, and they had a really good line on class and on the material differences between women. But they were often so theoretical, they just didn't engage me personally. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the same passion about it. So I felt that each was missing something, actually. But my heart went more and more with radical feminists. So that's where I eventually aligned myself. Although I worked a lot with some wonderful socialist feminists and had some really close relations, friendly relations with some of them, many of whom, a woman, Jane, in the Communist Party particularly, had similar critiques of their own party's stance on feminism and on women. Mm-hmm. It's not like anybody really was totally satisfied with any ideology, mm-hmm. maybe except the Maoists. They were really in class by themselves. I think everybody was grappling because, really nobody has the whole line on anything. So, yeah. But does that answer it?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. That's good. Okay, so, all right, so the follow-up question from her was, did it shift over your life? Did anything influence it to change over your life?
My ideological position?
Yes.
Well, having a son and a little, he was only two when I became a feminist. Definitely influenced me away from separatism, even in my wildest radical feminist days. I just never could have left him. I mean, other women did, but I just couldn't. So I always felt committed ideologically to the fact that women really should just, as the saying used to be, kick from where you stand. You didn't have to change your position in order to fight against women's oppression and work for women. I thought that all women should be able to work within their relationships with men, within their work relationships, within their communities, for women's liberation. Not that you had to live in a women's commune, for example. I mean, other women were making other decisions. And I always felt that it was better that women were making different decisions, because then they really were everywhere. I just emotionally, I always felt like it's really better that we're not all doing the same thing. And I never felt that there was only one real question and one real answer. It just never made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I did struggle a lot with, you know, do I stay with my husband because I really love him, or because we're just used to each other, or it's, you know, economically easier, blah, blah. And I did eventually not want to be with him and want to be with women. My life circumstances have totally changed. I still don't call myself a separatist, but I basically, my life is with women.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of male friends from a long time ago. I'm friendly with my former husband. We don't see each other all that much, but we're very friendly. I adore my son. I don't see him all that much. So I still wouldn't call myself a separatist, but from day to day, I hardly see any men. And in my work life, since I've been in Canada, I've only worked with women, really. Well, maybe when I was a fitness instructor, I marginally worked with men, but mostly I've worked with women. I mean, I know husbands of a few straight friends, but I don't really interact with them much. But that hasn't made me feel, I think, any different about separatism as an ideology. It's just not my way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do feel that the radical feminism that I kind of was brought up in my feminist years, did not have a strong enough take on differences between women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I look back and I reread some of the writings that I loved in the 70s, I look back, I read it now and I think, oh my God, why didn't we see it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because you just don't. You're so used to your own reality. I think that the majority of radical feminist writings do assume that most women are white. They do assume that North American priorities are every woman's priority. They do. I mean, it was hilarious. There'd be six of us sitting in a living room in Ealing thinking we knew what was best for women all over the world. I mean, the arrogance is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were a lot younger. Some of that comes with. I think that is a lot of it. You know, this theory was made by really young women who were doing it ourselves with not any guidance, really, except by other women like ourselves. And the books we were reading, first of all, the number of feminist books on a shelf in 1970, you know, was like three. We didn't have a lot to go on, and the books that were being written in a hurry. By women now, I think, my God, weren't you brave? Someone like Shulamith Firestone, you know, writing The Dialectic of Sex. This, what was she, 22 or something, taking on Freud and Marx and these big guys as though she was their peer. I thought it was marvelous. But if you go back and read it, you think, oh, shit, what was she thinking? What were we thinking? It's very limited. It's very unsatisfying now in a lot of ways. But that's how theory goes. You build on theory.
Now, when you were teaching women's studies, by that time, a couple of decades had gone by. And did you then see the limitations of those writings?
That's so interesting. At the beginning, no. And basically, I started teaching 1990. I was teaching my feminism, even though some of the writings weren't my specific feminism. But that's the only feminism I knew, really, was radical feminism. Mm-hmm. And the only way I thought of women's studies was, this is the feminism of women in the university, because that's the only way I could make sense of women's studies. I didn't have a take on it otherwise. And so for the first few years, that's what I was teaching. And then, in the middle of the 90s, about 1994, 95, things really started to change. It was already changing in the wide world, but I think in the mid-90s at UVic, in the Women's Studies Department, the struggles around racism, particularly, started to hit home. And I started to see with different eyes. And I remember, because I was teaching second wave feminism, and I was teaching it as my feminism, as feminism. And it was almost like from one term to the next, I suddenly realized that these foundational texts were so deeply flawed. It's interesting how you start to talk to people and you start to get new analyses, and then you just can't go back. And just like, you know, once feminism hit me, I couldn't go back to seeing it the old patriarchal way. Mm-hmm. Once the kind of, particularly the anti-racist analyses started to hit me, I couldn't go back and see feminism the old way. And I'm glad, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of a shock. And it was kind of difficult in many ways to do this in the classroom in front of students, to be in the middle of a lecture and suddenly realize, oh, this is wrong, this is racist, this is flawed, and have to stop the lecture and say, you see what I just said? This is a good example of how we were wrong. And to have to undercut myself, really. It was very, in some ways, very exciting, in other ways, it was just terrifying to me. Also because students would pounce. And that's what I learned something, you know, because I remember when I was all fired up in the first flush of feminism, man, I would pounce. I would pounce on anybody who put a word wrong, especially the ones I was close to. And I started to get a sense of what it's like to be on the other side of that. So over the years, I've learned compassion and humor. I've learned that if someone is trying, sometimes it helps to give them a break. But I was learning along with my students, not only how to rethink it, but how to do that with other people. It was exhausting. As I say, it was really painful. And then there was other stuff going on in the department at the time around some of these changes. Stuff between faculty, stuff between students, stuff between faculty and students. I don't even want to get into the specifics. It was really painful. But I feel like we moved through it. Those of us who survived got stronger and clearer. And some people didn't survive. They just left.
Did you have a vision in your mind about what the good life or the better life would be?
Oh. Well, I think I always, once I started to get involved in feminism, I really believed in something called a feminist revolution. A radical feminist revolution that would be something that would take place, you know, not with like armies, revolutionary armies coming in and seizing the organs of the state and the communications and all that. But with women, you know, making these small changes in our daily lives all the time, and more women doing that, and somehow the sum total of all these tiny changes would be that one morning everybody would wake up and they would go, oh my God, everything's changed. And it would have been that kind of revolution. And I think I thought of it in terms of, well, especially around work, interestingly enough. I mean, my big interests 30 years ago were definitely sex. You know, intellectually as well as just personally. I thought that sexuality was right at the heart of women's, not only women's oppression, but women's liberation. And that tapping into that sexual power was a way of tapping into political power, a general personal power and a political power. So that was really big for me. Also work and the way that work was organized. I thought that after the revolution, work would be organized just completely differently. And I think in my mind, feminism, real feminism, was organized along anarchist lines. That is, that the people who did the work should decide how the work should be done. And that, I mean, capitalism would be nowhere. There's no way you could structure in some people being richer than others into a feminist utopia. It's a non-starter. So I took it for granted that it would be not only just not capitalist, but anti-capitalist, but not centrally organized like most socialist kinds of organization. I took it for granted that it was some form of anarchism that would be worked out as we went along, and that a lot of things might not get done for a while. You know, that it would be kind of organized the way we organized feminist conferences. If somebody wanted to do it, it would get done. If nobody wanted to do it, maybe it wasn't worth doing. In terms of, you know, looking after the sewers and the cleaning the toilets, or the, you know, kind of the unpleasant jobs that nobody would think to probably want, mm-hmm. I assumed that we would work out some equitable way of doing that. But it wasn't clear in my mind or anything. I was definitely not working on blueprints. Mm-hmm. But I definitely thought, yeah, an anarchist approach to doing things. Of course, everything was, we thought more communally in those days. So we assumed sort of communal allotment gardens. We assumed communal childcare. We assumed communal approaches to things. Communal organization of laundry, probably. I assumed not coupled lives. I assumed that everybody would just be an individual, and you would have these relationships, and people would come and go. But we were definitely anti-couple, and non-monogamy was kind of the order of the day. Suited me fine. I liked it.
Did you have the energy for it?
Well, I was young. I did. And I also, I lack a certain kind of imagination. So I'm not somebody who, if I wasn't with my lover and I knew my lover was with somebody else, I would sit there and imagine what they were doing and suffer agonies. I'm much more out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. So I just think temperamentally I was more suited for it than some people. I mean, I wouldn't have the energy now. but, you know, I still think it's a good idea. I don't repudiate it intellectually. Mm-hmm. I think I assumed, yeah, much more collectivity, much more doing what you wanted, and not being driven by obligation. And I assumed that we would all just be happier better people. And we would want to do mostly what was right. I mean, you know, this is crazy, but I think that's kind of
okay
how I felt.
Okay, and one more. She just wrote down a couple of words.
Yeah.
Justification for activism.
Okay, justification for activism. Well, one of the fun things about being a feminist then was that you started with consciousness raising, and once you'd all gone around the circle a couple of times and identified your problems and talked about it, then you thought about, well, what can we do? And other women were doing that as well. And all the activism really came out of consciousness raising about, and it was addressing our own problems. And for example, actually my very first feminist action was to go on the picket line with the women night cleaners in London. Women who cleaned offices at night, and they were not unionized. They were being prevented from being unionized. It was contracted out to these terrible companies. The women had terrible working conditions. They often had to lock their children in their flats and go out to work at night. The companies wouldn't hire enough people, so they were working their guts out for no money, terrible conditions, and nobody cared. It was like the invisible work that got done at night. That was my very first action. My second action was to do with women at a shoe company who were being made redundant, and they had formed a leather co-op and were making leather bags, and we helped them sell their bags. I mean, the relationship between my consciousness raising about my own economic position and these women's, which were very different, they were in a very different economic position, mm-hmm. but it made me see the connection between women's work and the exploitation of women in work and my own possibilities of work as a woman, and the fact that I would always be economically dependent on my husband because he would always earn more money than me, and it wasn't an accident. So action was never undertaken just because somebody thought it was a good idea. It was always connected to my own needs. I did a lot of activism around reproductive rights at the time, like in the 70s when I was in England, and here in the 80s. I did some of the activism was in England was semi or even totally illegal, and that was fun too. I mean, it was that moment when you just felt laws just don't count. They're patriarchal, they're classes, they're everything else. They just don't apply to me. I mean, that was the fun thing, you know. Laws, they didn't apply. And you could act as though they weren't there. Until you got caught, of course. actually, in Victoria, this is jumping ahead a bit, Andrea Dworkin came to speak here in the early 90s, I think. And I thought she was great. A lot of people, you know, don't like her. Radical feminist. I thought she was a brilliant theorist.
She wrote Woman Hating, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Right-Wing Women, and just a ton of books. And she's kind of a classic radical feminist. So anyway, she gave this talk, and a lot of it was about pornography and violence against women. And shortly after that, a friend of mine and I went out in the middle of the night and threw a brick through the window of a porn shop in Esquimalt. Well, number one, you can't just throw a brick through one of those windows. Those windows are really heavy. It took two goes. But the second time, I really threw it hard. It felt fabulous just to break that window. It felt really great for about 5 minutes until we heard the police siren. We did get arrested. We never went to trial. It was a kind of a silly thing. We thought we would go to trial and make big statements, and it never happened. It never went to trial. It kind of just petered out, but it was really fun. And that was when there was still more or less a consensus in feminism around pornography, that pornography was a form of violence against women. And that was another one of the changes in the 90s that just threw me for a loop. That suddenly that analysis was seen by a whole bunch of people as deeply flawed and deeply anti-woman in some ways, and anti-sex, which just shocks me. Because our analysis was much more that pornography helps to construct sexuality. It's not that we were anti-sex, it was because we were pro-sex, that we were against porn. I haven't read them for a long time, but the last time I had a look at Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon's take on pornography, For me, it still holds. Even though I never liked the idea of suing, like there's this Minneapolis ordinance that they got passed of suing in civil court for the damages and the harm done by pornography to women. I don't actually feel good about engaging legal processes for most women for a huge variety of reasons. To take this back to activism, I really like activism, and always have, that doesn't follow the law necessarily. Like even recently, there was this march for they called the Stolen Sisters, the Aboriginal women.
Absolutely, this past weekend.
This past weekend, which unfortunately I was too sick at the time to go to, but there was a bit of a conflict about whether they should get a permit to vary their march trajectory from one spot to another. I said, go do it where you want, and if you have a fine, I'll find the money for you. I mean, I just hate this idea of you apply to the state to sanction your march. You're asking the same people to support, you know, to support you as you're trying to supplant. That's why I was never against women getting money from the state. I have been against state-funded feminist activism. Even when I was funded by it, I was against it. And I think it was a huge mistake. We did way less of it in England in the 70s. It was all grassroots. It was all activists. There was no idea of volunteer work. You didn't do this on behalf of somebody else. You did it for yourself. And I still think that's a better model, actually. I think it's more fruitful. Although, that phrase burnout, I think, was coined in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's hard to do that forever. And certainly people like you and me, I mean, we don't have that kind of energy anymore. Mm-hmm. Partly because we did so much then, I'm sure. Maybe there's a place for it, I haven't rethought it, but I think activism should be people doing it for themselves and because of what they know, in support of other people as well. And I think it should be fun. I don't think it should be drudgery. I think you should do it the way you want to do it, and that the way you organize it is part of the activism. Doesn't start with the action, it starts with the organizing of it. And I think if you want diversity, you have to structure it in from the beginning. I do know that in the last, say, 10 years, there's been much more awareness of the fact that, oh my God, we're all white women in this room. Mm-hmm. We have nobody else, you know. Well, you don't deal with that effectively at the last minute. You deal that effectively with that effectively at the beginning. When you're starting to plan, you don't pull in people off the street just because they have a disability. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that. I think experience gives you greater depth in your activism and in your organizing. And again, more compassion and humor, because you see all the times, I mean, I see all the times I just fell short. I fell so short, either because I didn't realize or because just my own limitations or the limitations of the people I was working with or whatever. You fall short, and then that's made me much more understanding of other people who fall short. And then you start to understand that being angry all the time doesn't really endear many people to your cause. And it hardly ever causes people to rethink their position. It just makes them defensive. So my own activism has definitely changed over the years. I mean, anger used to be a good strategy. I think it was a great strategy to help women get over our fear of men and the kind of awe of men and male power and authority figures. It was very useful. And then I think you get to a certain point and you don't need it anymore. Or you can draw on it more selectively. So I would say my personal activism is now much more likely to use barbed humor than it is to yell and scream.
Don't you think that causes people to be defensive as well?
The yelling and screaming, or the barbed humor? Really? It might, but I hope to disarm them a little bit. Mm-hmm. Just I don't know. You don't always get it right. But it might. But it
just a little pricks.
Yeah. I mean, you can't always get the balance right. I have a friend who has also really made me think about if you go around assuming that people are going to fall down and they're not going to come through, then you treat them with a kind of preemptive scorn that tends to put them off. If you kind of assume that people can come through and you sort of play to their better self, sometimes it helps them to present their better self. I don't want to get too new agey about this. Mm-hmm. I still think you have to have a really structural way of looking at things and not just personal. But I think that the way that we convey our analysis shapes people's response to it. And I think it doesn't matter if you have the best analysis, the most perfect take on things in the whole universe. Number one, if you can't communicate it to anybody, it's not helpful. Number two, if you can't work with anybody who doesn't share your own perfect, exquisite set of analyses, it's not very useful. You have to be able to work with people as they are and then help them move along. Or you don't work with them. I mean, that's the beauty of separatism. You don't have to work with people who structurally are antagonistic to you. And I respect separatism for that, in that regard. But I think if you're not a separatist, if you're working with a mixture of people, then you have to have some respect for them, or why should they pay any attention to you? You know, and I think you have to be willing to learn from them. That's why coalition politics is so interesting, but also difficult, because you have to work with people that, in some regards, they are still structurally your oppressors. I keep coming back to the structural thing, because I think that one of the things that's been lost in our intensely personal and individualized era right now is a structural analysis of why women are still oppressed and why people generally might be oppressed. there's a big resistance to talking about oppression as a structural phenomenon. It's like some old-fashioned thing. You know, nobody wants to hear about capitalism anymore, or, you know, anti-capitalism, or racism as a structural set of processes rather than as certain feelings that people might hold.
Institutionalized.
Yeah. And systemic.
Mm-hmm.
That's not out there in the popular culture. And I think that we need to still find ways to talk about things structurally, but without using the kind of academic jargon that they do in women's studies, because nobody will listen to that. I won't even listen to it anymore. You have to be able to talk about daily life with a theoretical approach, but in the words of daily life, I think, so that women who don't have an academic background can use those words as their tools. I mean, you can't access academic tools if you don't have the whole academic rigmarole, because that gives them, it's the rigmarole that gives it the context that makes the tools meaningful, and gives it the context that most people just don't have.
Outside of academia.
Outside of academia. I'm going to be able to talk to women in the laundrette and the supermarket and in gym class, you know. I don't want to have to only talk to women who already have my understanding. Not that women in the supermarket don't have my understanding, but I'm going to be able to talk about it in terms of everyday life.
Do you have any thoughts about why this kind of structural analysis has gotten lost?
Oh, geez. Well, I think in the 80s, none of us was looking, and we lost. You had Thatcher, you had Mulroney, you had Reagan. And between them, they changed the world. And the economics, this is where the radical feminists badly screwed up. I think we did not give the kind of importance to world economics that we should have. And the whole economic system changed when we weren't looking, and when we woke up, it was too late. And because it changed, everything else changed. And suddenly, we were too disjointed to be able to make a big difference. Also, I think the internal differences between us had come to such a crunch that it was hard to work together. I think the kind of difficult transitions that I was talking about earlier that we had to make in women's studies also had to be made outside in the world, and sometimes they were made and sometimes they weren't. And one of the things I've seen is that women with more privilege left the movement in droves. As soon as there was really hard struggle. For example, when there was really hard struggle around racism, a lot of white women just said, well, this isn't fun anymore, I'm out of here. Or, you know, if you're not talking about me, I'm out of here. A lot of middle-class women when the economics changed, I think what happened was that those of us who had the possibility of making money, we had to make money. It was like this moment when the crunch had come, the shit had hit the fan, and everybody who could had to feather our own nests, because suddenly the money wasn't there. It was much harder to get jobs. The bottom fell out. And so those of us with privilege called in our chips and got jobs. And women who didn't have that became poorer. That's when you started to get this bigger gap between the upper middle classes and the poor, certainly in North America and the rest of the world too, actually. So I think that that made a huge difference. That's when so many women started teaching women's studies instead of being street corner feminist activists, or going into these government-funded positions in government-funded organizations, working for the Ministry of Women's Equality, again, rather than working on the street, because we needed jobs. And I think that's had a huge effect on the women's movement. I mean, because effectively, we were putting so much effort into our work lives, and getting a bit older, we just didn't have it left over for the women's movement. The women's movement was fighting. I think pornography, that fight about pornography, also took a lot of the heart out of the women's movement, because it was all just fighting about pornography. And then that the kind of S&M, the so-called pro-sex, anti-sex kind of false dichotomy got in there. And it just felt like, I don't have time to worry about this. There was less and less pulling me, certainly, into feminist activism, more and more pushing me away from it, and it was becoming my paid work. Once it became my paid work, I was less interested in doing it on the weekend, frankly. The other thing, the economics really brought an end, eventually, say, to feminist bookstores and feminist publishing. This is something I was deeply involved in once I got to Canada, was Every Woman's Books.
Okay, well, we lost a bit of information on the tape, so I'm going to ask you to just repeat what you were saying about the beginning in the history of Every Woman's Books here in Victoria.
Yeah, so Every Woman's Books started in 1975. I was saying, it's like a classic second wave feminist project. These women couldn't find the feminist reading material they wanted in the bookstores in Victoria, so they started their own. And they put in $500, and they started a collectively owned and run bookstore that carried on until 1997. It started in a small storefront in Oak Bay, and then it moved downtown. And I joined in 1982, about 6 months after I came to Victoria. I finally was ready for some feminist activism again. And the collective tended to be about 24 women. It was shifting, floating. Women left and new women joined all the time. In many ways, it was really diverse. It had women who were maybe 18 up to women in their 70s. Pretty much always there was an age range that was really nice. There was a class range from very upper middle class ladies to working class women. There was definitely a huge range of feminist ideology. Again, everything from just nice ladies who wanted to do some good work with other women in the community to radical feminist separatists, everything in between. There were academics, there were nurses, there were bank clerks, there were just everything. House cleaners, midwives, women with disabilities, just all sorts. Racially, it was much less mixed. There would often be maybe one woman of color or one woman of First Nations background. Usually not more than one, which was never satisfactorily addressed. There was a mixture of lesbian bisexual, straight women always. And in my experience, it worked as a mixed collective better than most that I've come into. I mean, basically everybody got to be out about everything, their boyfriends, their girlfriends, their no friends, their whatever. So that part was really good. And the fact that we gave, put on readings meant that we could bring in all kinds of women. And we brought in lots of women of color, for example, to give readings. Lots of lesbians to give readings. Lots of non-mainstream writers to give readings. Those were really fun, and I like to organize them a lot. The thing about the bookstore is, again, this is, has to do with the shift in economics. Eventually, mainstream bookstores started to carry the more lucrative end of feminist publishing. So women didn't have to come to us for some of those. And we were committed to selling feminist books that we thought should be on the bookshelves of any feminist store. So, for example, we would have a copy of, say, The Second Sex. It didn't matter if we only sold one every 2 years. Mm-hmm. We could make decisions that were feminist decisions, not business decisions, for a long time. But not, well, not into the 90s. Then things started to change. They changed for us, and they changed for other bookstores as well. So what happened was a lot of women, number one, didn't have to come to Every Woman's for the kind of fluffy end of feminist and women's writings. They could go other places. Some bookstores had longer hours. They had better parking. Boland's Books in the mall, you could always park. It was open every day until 9 o'clock. Our volunteer structure started to break down because more women had to work more hours to make a living, had less time for volunteering. It used to be you could live on UI for most of the year. So there was a woman who drove a bus for 4 months a year and spent probably 40 hours a week in the bookstore the rest of the year, and she really kept it going a lot. A lot of women had, you know, were able to do that. I was able to do that for a while when I was on UI. So we had a lot more time. And then as the economics shifted, women didn't have so much time. Younger women especially were finding it harder to get by on just one job. They would be in the low end of the service industry. They might have two or three jobs, or they were leaving town because Victoria didn't have a lot of work. So we couldn't hold volunteers long enough. And you have to train people. It takes a while. So we started experiencing that frequent turnover, and that meant that our personal relations broke down too. We didn't have the time to cultivate the strong personal dynamics in the bookstore. So it kind of gets you spinning in a negative spiral. The rate of exchange between the U.S. and Canada comes in there, because so much feminist, not just books, but paraphernalia especially, buttons and cards and paraphernalia comes from the States. So it's really expensive if the Canadian dollar is low. And a lot of that stuff you have to pay ahead. And so the economics were getting to us. If we didn't have the volunteers, we couldn't always afford to be as selective about volunteers. So we had women who weren't so suitable. So maybe the store was closed when it was supposed to be open more. So women would come and they would find it closed and they wouldn't come back, or they would get angry. So that was a problem. One of the things that happened, and I credit Christine St. Peter in Women's Studies with this, she got Every Woman's to order a lot of Women's Studies texts. And that made students aware of the bookstore. They would have to come down and get their books there. In many ways, that was a godsend, a godsend, I guess I should say. It brought more money into the store, big infusions of money. It brought more women into the store. And then we got lots of volunteers from that cohort as well. Eventually, the UVic bookstore, I think, had a bit of a, got their nose out of joint about it because it was taking money away from them. The other thing is some students couldn't be bothered to go downtown, so they would go to the UVic bookstore and they wouldn't have the book and the students would get angry. So eventually we had to stop doing that. Also, some women's studies profs ordered books that were kind of from far out publishers, and it was hard to get them. So we weren't always able to get them on time. And of course, that was a problem. So that dried up. So then we got into this bigger and deeper hole. And then the interesting thing, this technology is fascinating. The computerization finished us off. Because there's a whole social organization of technology that people don't pay enough attention to. And I don't know, do you want me to go into this detail?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For example, one of the things you have to do in a bookstore, you have to pay the bills, you have to order the books. This used to be something that you could take the book catalogs home, mark them up, we write out the order, send it in on your own time. Eventually, you had to do that on a computer. Well, we could only afford one computer. They didn't have laptops then. You know, this was the 90s. Computers were just starting to be used, really, in workplaces. We could only afford one. If you have a networked computer, in which you have several in the same workplace, you have to pay a license for that, and it's expensive. The computers were expensive. The software, there's a specialized software for bookstores. That was expensive. We were a marginal production. So this was like an extra $5,000, which for us at the time was a huge amount of money. So we couldn't afford network computers, so we had one computer, which meant that if you wanted to order books, same with the bill paying, you used to be able to take the checkbook home, take the bills home, write the bills in the comfort of your living room and mail them off. Then eventually you had to pay the bills online or computerize your bill paying. It meant you had to come into the store, but you couldn't do it during store hours because the woman on shift needed the computer to make sales. So you had to do it when the store was shut. So that it just made it put constraints on it. Computers, when they were first out, I mean, they're fascinating. And we found that the woman on shift was spending all her time on the computer and maybe wouldn't make eye contact with the customers or spend enough time talking to the customers. Third, that computers are only as good as the information in them. We had to enter. We had like 5,000 book titles. We had to enter them all in the database. And people made mistakes, you know, they're not professional typists. So you'd come in, you'd ask for a book by Audre Lorde, somebody would have spelled Audre Lorde's name wrong, and you couldn't find her. So, or what the computer said we had didn't correlate with what was on the shelf. We had a lot of problems with the computers. We also lost a lot of the older women then, because at that time, older women were way less comfortable with computers. It wasn't fun for them. It meant we had to have a computerized cash box. We used to take cash, we had a fishing tackle box. And it was all just, it was so kind of loose and free and easy and kind of funky. With the computer, you couldn't be funky. You had to be precise. You know, the period had to be in this space and not that space. We lost a lot of women who didn't want to get in line with the computer. I mean, people now, everyone's more used to it, and they can figure out how to be funky and useful. And the programs are more user-friendly. We lost a lot, and we had to change the way we were. And a lot of women hated using the computer, and you'd get into this situation where everything would just freeze up on you, and you wouldn't know what to do. And there's three customers, and their parking meter is running out. And you just go, ah! It was a source of frustration. And in that atmosphere in which feminist activism had already become kind of redefined as volunteering, people were going, oh, this is my volunteer thing. It's not fun anymore. Goodbye. So between the struggles around diversity, the technological struggles, and the effect that that had on our personnel, we started to really feel it in our sales. And then we weren't making enough money to support ourselves. And we were too burnt out to do anything very effective about it. And we just eventually closed down. And I mean, women's bookstores all over North America and were closing down at the same time. It wasn't just us.
Mm-hmm.
But we did. And, you know, it was like a death. If I go down Johnson Street and I pass where the store was, in fact, I try not to go down Johnson Street there. I still miss it, you know. It was something so special. And when we were closing down, we did all these money-raising things so we could pay off all our bills, which we did. And women just said, oh, why didn't you tell us? We would have helped. And, you know, it's like a presence that's no longer there. And there's been nothing to take its place. And now nobody even knows it was there. And you don't get the books. Again, you can't buy those books in Victoria that we used to sell, but you can get them online. So the internet has really changed the way things get done. So you can buy the books, but you can't walk in there on a Saturday and run into somebody you'd meant to call last week, you know, or run into somebody you never met who's new in town and start up a conversation and invite her to dinner. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no physical space where we meet anymore. Which I think is a shame. I think it's a real shame, and it's a big loss.
Mm-hmm.
So what I see is this individualized, computerized way of interacting with the world that has some advantages, for sure, but has some real social disadvantages.
You certainly lose the collective aspect of
absolutely
strength.
Absolutely. Even things, and I still get this newsletter, I'll show it you later. I get it from England. It's the Older Feminist Network. It's the only newsletter I know that is still, it's typed and photocopied and collated, you know, by half a dozen women on the living room floor. I mean, nobody works that way anymore. Everybody emails something to one person who all by herself desktops it, sends it to the printer. You know, it's like a totally individualized production, and every newsletter has the same format. There's nothing interesting about newsletter formats anymore. They're all exactly the same. And one of my favorite political experiences, going back even to when I was a kid, and certainly through my feminist years, was of typing, either, you know, using the Gestetner, remember, rolling it out, or photocopying newsletters with, you know, the different pages all over the floor, six women collating all these pages, stapling them, stuffing them into envelopes, and talking all the time. We were talking, we were sharing experiences, we were organizing, we were deepening our relationships, you know, it was totally lost. The social organization of the production of newsletters. Nobody thinks about that. And I think it's a huge element of political organizing that needs to be brought back. And it was fun, you know? It was really fun, and you could do it on a Tuesday night or something. So the bookstore, you know, is gone, but maybe it'll come back in some other form.
Yeah. There was another issue that you indicated that you'd be willing to cover more, and you've already mentioned it a little bit today, and that's the abortion movement.
Ah.
I know that went on for a number of years, and you mentioned today that you were involved in it both in England and
here. Yeah. Okay. In England, I remember we went out and got signatures on petitions to try and change the abortion laws. This was in the early 70s. And I remember so much this punitive attitude towards women's sexuality. She got herself into this mess, you know, she should bear the consequences. I remember doing that. I remember going on demonstrations. I remember stickering campaigns in public, you know, slapping up stickers and posters in public places, lots of lobbying efforts in Parliament. I remember carrying a sign, no forced labor, on an abortion march. It was one of the central planks of the women's movement in England was initially abortion on demand. It was probably changed to reproductive freedom or something more general sounding. I still think abortion on demand is perfectly adequate, thank you very much. I was involved in abortion things, along with other things. And it was something that I felt very deeply about, because basically every woman I knew who'd been heterosexually active had had an abortion.
Is that right?
Practically. I don't know, I'm exaggerating, but a lot. And illegal abortions, and it was very traumatic. For me, that's pretty basic, that men should not have the right to say that women should have an abortion or not. That, and to me, that was like the clearest radical feminist argument you could get. That the very people who are in power over you have the ability to say whether or not you can access something that you only need because you're fucking with them anyway. And you're only fucking with them because that's the way they want to do it. You know, it really was clear to me. So when I came here, which was 1981, the way the law was, you had to have... In BC, you had to have two doctors basically sign for you in order to get an abortion. And they were on these hospital committees. And there became a big campaign by the Christian right, basically, the anti-abortion people, to stack the hospital committees so that women could not get abortions. So there were some bitter struggles here in the mid-1980s around hospital abortion, therapeutic abortion committee, that's what they were called, TAC, therapeutic abortion committee, because they were being stacked. And so a lot of struggles. And I started working for the Status of Women Action Group, SWAG, in 1986, so 86, 87, and 88, and that was like the high point of the anti-abortion struggles and the struggles for abortion. One of the things we did when I worked at SWAG, we had a rally at the legislature, and do you remember Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale?
Oh, yes.
Well, we had all these women in costume from that book in red costumes, as part of the theatrics of the rally. We had a really big rally at the time. And I remember I stood on the steps of the legislature and made a speech. A bunch of other people made speeches, and we had all these handmaidens come in. It was a whole big thing. It was in the papers, and that was really fun. I also, at the time, they had a lot of stuff on television, so I was on television a lot, debating. I was on the radio. That's when I became a public person in Victoria. And it was really hard. It was very traumatic for me. Number one, everybody knew who I was, suddenly. So people would come up to me in the supermarket and start telling me their abortion stories. Or they would phone me at home. I got this phone call at home from someone with kind of an elderly, middle-class British lady's accent. And she said, you know, is this Deborah Gregory, my name was at the time. And I just thought, she's going to scream at me, I'm a baby killer, you know. And then she poured out her heart about, can't even remember if it's her own abortion story or her sister's. Women were just, and not even women, men, were pouring their hearts out to me about their traumatic abortion stories. And I'm an emotional sponge anyway. Mm-hmm. And I was just taking it all in. I found it really hard. That's when I took my name out of the phone book. And I had to be on all the time because I was getting these phone calls from the media and interviews. And my sense of feminism was never that one woman should speak for anybody else. We never did that in England. We had always had collective media presence. But suddenly I was put in this position where I was expected to be the media voice for SWAG. And in the meantime, the anti-abortion people were really targeting the one doctor in Victoria who would do abortions. They were putting, you know, shit on her doorstep and cutting up dolls' heads and limbs and putting them in her mailbox and really targeting her in terrible, ugly ways. So it was scary. And then we had another big rally. I remember people were coming in. They were giving us money at SWAG to fuel the abortion rights campaign. This guy who worked with my former husband just walked in and said, how much does it cost for an abortion? And wrote a check, you know. We could hardly get the money to the bank fast enough. I mean, it was just so intense and so polarized. And I couldn't wear the same thing twice because the television people would be in my office all the time, you know. But I learned better how to speak on the media and how to get my stuff across because the anti-abortionists had very skilled media people. And I wasn't at all. Then in, I think it was 88, the Supreme Court finally ruled in favor of specifically Dr. Morgenthaler, and they just took it out of the criminal code altogether. And basically it's never gone back in the criminal code. Canada is so interesting. We have no abortion law. Mm-hmm. Just none. And in one way, it's wonderful. I mean, we have the problem of we don't have equal access. It means each province is free to do what they want, and some provinces don't fund it. Is that right? Yeah. Oh, if you're in PEI, you pretty much have to go somewhere else to get an abortion. Yeah, I think I'm not up on the latest and greatest because I don't have to follow these things anymore. Mm-hmm. But basically, because there's no law, there's no requirement to fund abortion on the provincial health plans. which means if your province doesn't fund it, you have to either pay privately, which can be very expensive, or you have to go elsewhere, which is always traumatic and, of course, more expensive and difficult.
How was it in BC?
If you're in a big city, you're okay. Again, if you're in a small town, you might have to come to Victoria. But again, I'm not up on it in terms of research. I don't follow it.
Do you know whether the government funds it here?
Oh, I'm sure they do. I'm sure it's funded.
Okay.
But again, not every hospital has to provide it. And they did institute also clinics outside of hospitals. And the anti-choice people bombarded these clinics, I mean, you know, sometimes literally with bombs.
Really?
And there's been shootings in Vancouver. Doctor was shot. And then the terrible kinds of picket lines and harassment for women coming in to get abortions. Now they've had what they call a bubble zone law, I think, so that they can't picket right in front of the clinics. I don't know. You don't hear about it so much anymore, so maybe it's all settled down. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, you know, if you're in a small town, it makes a big difference.
Something else that happened, I think, when you were just starting to teach women's studies, was the Montreal Massacre. And you indicated when you gave him a speech at the memorial for it at UVic this past year, you indicated that that sort of had an emotional impact on you too.
Oh, that was huge. The Montreal Massacre happened in December 6th, 1989, when this guy just walked in and killed 14 women. He said, "You're feminists, I hate feminists, I'm going to kill you."
And that was, where was, what's that?
Was that was the École Polytechnique in Montreal. So that was December. So I started teaching women's studies that January. So it was really fresh. It was very shocking. That was the first school shooting, you know. I mean, now there's Columbine, there's all these, every other week some guy goes in and shoots up schools. It was still shocking. And it was kind of like the feminist dystopia come true. You know, my God, they're shooting women because they're feminists. It was like a huge nightmare. So it felt, to be on campus and to be identified with women's studies, to me, felt scary. Because this guy, it wasn't women he was targeting. He was targeting people he thought were feminists. So I just had these flashes of some guy walking in my classroom one day saying, "You're a bunch of feminists, I'm going to shoot you." Mm-hmm. For probably the whole first term.
What kind of repercussions did it have in the women's communities or the feminist communities? I mean, you still commemorate it.
We organized something right away in Centennial Square, women were just kind of walking around stunned. It really was shocking. Does that mean that's
good? No, it's not.
So we organized swag. I was no longer working at swag, but swag in the bookstore and various people organized a rally in Centennial Square, probably still in December, I don't remember. And somebody asked me to speak. It was probably my second public speech in Victoria, the first one being that abortion one. And I worked very hard on it because I felt that we really, we just needed something. I mean, I'm still getting teary. It was like, they're killing us, literally, because they think we're feminists. It was so shocking. And I gave a magnificent speech, if I do say so myself. And I ended it with a promise to commit 14 feminist acts every year in their memory. Because I felt like you have to leave people with something positive. You can't leave people just wallowing in fear and misery. And I thought about that for years afterwards. And people told me, actually, they thought about it for years afterwards. I started, you know, this is the funny thing. I'm going to bring it back to me. I was always a really shy, very deeply unhappy, very deeply neurotic child. And it's only feminism that gave me gradually the confidence to speak. I never said 10 words. The whole time I was in university, I might have asked one question in a classroom, maybe one. I had no public voice at all. It's only feminism that did that for me, that gave me the gradually growing confidence to say things, first in a room full of other women and then out in the general public. And I understood finally, and again gradually, that I had the capacity to move other women to feel and to act in good ways. It's like a miracle for me because I wasn't brought up to it. I was brought up that women should be seen and not heard, and it was what you looked like that counted, and too much talking wasn't good, and what you did on a date was to draw a boy out and ask him about himself, and talking about yourself was like, oh, the biggest taboo. So it's been interesting for me, just as a thread, to see that I could speak in public. And so I think that fed into my teaching, and my teaching fed back into it. And I did more and more public speaking. And I quite like it now. And I discovered that the me who speaks in public, in fact, isn't the private me. It's a narrative me who can get up there and do these things, that the private me would die first, you know, really. I'm so shy. People have no idea how shy I am. But I found it also helpful, because when you have to speak, you have to figure out what you think. So making that talk at that rally for those women really helped clarify for me what I felt. And the thing about violence against women, I mean, on one level, here we are in Victoria. There's probably no place safer in the whole world for women. It's got a huge population of older women. I walk out all the time without ever thinking about, do I feel safe or not? And on the other hand, you can get picked off any second. That woman was just thrown in front of a car the other day and killed. She's just standing there, you know. Violence against women is so everywhere. It's so part of our social fabric, even here in so-called safe Victoria, that half the time we just negotiate it without even thinking about it. So, you know, as a topic, as an issue, I think it's still really big. It's obviously big around the world when you look at women in wars, when you look at women in Africa who've been just systematically raped and maimed as part of civil war, or, you know, women in these rape camps, blah, blah, blah. But all over. I mean, the whole world is one big rape camp in one way. See, that's the kind of a radical feminist thing to say that probably doesn't bear scrutiny. But I still feel that way. And the economics, again, affects women with violence, because the more you're dependent on men to keep you from being homeless, the more vulnerable you are to violence in your own personal relationship. The more you are homeless, the more you're vulnerable to violence on the street. Women are still vulnerable to violence at every level, of sexual violence, of battery. The violence against women isn't always as dramatic as the Montreal massacre, but it's always there. And we seem to take for granted now that women's shelters for battered women and sexual assault centers are always going to be there. They're always underfunded. They're never organized properly. Nobody's talking about doing the work that would prevent the need for them. We're still getting money from the state to fund them. The state is mainly still white men. Why are we asking these people for money when they're the ones who are in charge of everything that's making the world difficult?
What kind of work do you think would need to be done in order to prevent the need for them?
Oh, God. I think we would just have to put everyone to sleep and start over. You know, really, you'd have to just stop and start over. I think it would have to be such a multi-directional, multi-dimensional project all at once, because it is partly economic, it is partly social, it's the way people are brought up, it's what they know. It's very self-fulfilling. If you grow up knowing that you're a member of the class of people that has the power to inflict this kind of violence, that's always part of your knowledge, whether you act on it or not. It's part of your oppressor's toolkit to give you a certain way of being in the world. If you know that you grow up being part of the world that is targeted for violence, again, that's part of your toolkit. It's part of how you are in the world, whether you specifically, overtly ever are the victim of it or not. So it's woven into our psyches from such an early age. So it's partly psychological. It's partly governmental in the way that, for example, the structure of global economics, that women are sent around the world to do domestic labor in situations where they are alone and stuck in a house with people who have all this power over her. So you're kind of multiply, massively stuck in these situations. Even women who have other kinds of privilege, you know, tend to be channeled into pair bonding with men who are older, bigger, stronger, richer, higher class, you know, have all these other power bases. It's no big surprise that women get beat up in their relationships. It's kind of structured that way, and it's more a surprise when we don't. So I think, you know, so much would have to change that it's almost hard to imagine it happening, except as a byproduct of other changes. It's certainly part of the media. You know, the mass media, in which violence against women is part of the subject matter. It's part of the way a lot of the media are produced. And it's sort of seen as, if you worry about it, it's sort of old hat, old fashioned, you know, not with it. Younger women are, it's like if I choose it, then it's not oppressive because I've chosen it. So it's very really hard to see how it could actually be different. Sorry. But I think probably it would be a result of other things changing and not the changing itself that would cause other things to change. That's my guess.
Okay. You, while you were teaching, you taught classes on lesbian studies as well.
I did. For my sins.
Okay, and I think you said that you taught a class on lesbian studies at one point, and you taught it from classic lesbian feminist theory. And then some time went by and you were asked to teach it again.
Yes.
Can you tell me about when you taught it the first time and then how much time went by and when you taught it the second time?
Yeah. I taught it the first time with my colleague at the time, Michelle Pujol, who actually, when she interviewed to be hired at UVic, she said in her interview that one of her objectives or plans or hopes was to teach the first lesbian studies course there. And she and someone else and I kind of developed the course together, thinking that she would teach it. But so many women signed up for it that they needed a second section, so I taught it as well. So she and I taught it together.
When was that?
I think, I want to say about 1994 or 95, somewhere in there. So what we did, we taught it, it was one night a week for 3 hours, and we each had our own section, and sometimes we each would teach our own class, and sometimes the two sections would come together, and we would either have guest speakers, or the two of us would jointly teach the class, or whatever. It was very fun, it was very exciting. The class readings were about 6 inches thick. I found out later nobody did all the reading because we kind of put in everything that we thought everybody should know. And that was a kind of the apotheosis of lesbian feminist writing. There was a ton of stuff. And so we photocopied a lot. We had Peace in My Heart. I don't know if you're familiar with it as a non-Canadian. Mm-hmm. It was the first Canadian Lesbians of Color anthology, edited by Makeda Silvera. And it had just a wide variety. And then we had tons of stuff that, I think that might have been the only, I forget all the other texts. That's the one actual text I remember, plus all the photocopied writings that was like everything we loved. And it was a class that had a lot of lesbians, had not a lot of non-lesbians. And the very first class in my section, I said, this is lesbian space. And I want it clear that everybody's welcome, but I want the lesbians to be happy. Because this is the only class they're ever going to get. And the rest of you have to, you know, get to sit through classes where you're the one that they're talking about. And the lesbians have to sit on the sidelines, metaphorically at least, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the class where we're talking about lesbians. So if you have problems with that and you're not a lesbian, come see me outside of class, but don't bring it into class. It was very empowering for lesbians in that way. Mm-hmm. And we had lots of fun. And we did do some whole class work and then small group work. And in some of the small groups, we had the students meet in groups of lesbians, straight women, bisexual women, and other, I think. Because nobody wanted to be in the straight group. because, you know, the lesbians were the cool people in that class. And you know, there were problems with the class, I'm sure, but it was really fun to teach. I do remember that. It was very empowering and thrilling. And then they had other people to teach it. You know, it was never my area of academic work. It was just what I did for fun. It was my life. Mm-hmm. So they had other people to teach it for.